You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. Today, I'm extraordinarily pleased to bring you a stone-cold banger of an episode with Foil, Arms and Hogg. Now, I begin this episode with a little apology to the boys because I've never seen them live. I've always seen their posters at the Edinburgh Festival, and I guess there was something that looked a little bit too clean-cut about them. I was like, no, sketch act, three white guys, sure. What a fool I was. They're so, so good. Their YouTube content, which comprises lots of clips from their live shows, which I now wish I had been at. All of that stuff precedes them. They are wonderful. And the more I mention them to people, the more I realise loads of my friends are really into them and they have this huge kind of cult following. We will go on in this episode to discuss a little bit about the difference between live fans, their live following, and their YouTube fans, and the different ways in which they are kind of famous, underground, famous, permanent underdogs. We'll get into all of that. There are 40 minutes of absolutely cracking extras from this episode in which we talk about they share their homemade vocabulary of sketch writing terms, including the Matrix, the Swan Dive, how to Chris Rock something, and so much more. There's a lovely bit where I force them to describe in excruciating detail each other's strengths and weaknesses. All of that at comedianscomedian.com/insiders to sign up for all the extra content from this show, which is hundreds of hours now, for only £2 a month, or however much more you feel like spending on top of that, because you love the show and recognise that you've been listening for nearly 10 years in some cases, or you've been listening to this intro and thought, this is bloody good, I'm going to get hold of these extras. It's entirely up to you. Here's Sean, Connor and Sean, a.k.a. Foil, Arms and Hogg. Where are you at the moment? Are you in your office? And have you, in fact, rented an office in order to film sketches based in offices?
Yeah, we have an office. It's our second office. Gone through two offices.
Yeah.
It was funny because the last office didn't look like an office, so whenever we wanted to do office stuff, we had to...
You had to dress it as an office.
Yeah. We have so many kind of big flats that we just move in with different wallpapers on them and all sorts of different things that the hardest thing for our office to look like is an office.
Yeah.
We can make it look like a living room easier than we can make it look like an office.
You have wallpapered walls on flats, on wheels.
Yeah,
big, we have.
Like, they're right over here.
10 of them, yeah.
You do realise you're sitting in front of a green screen, so I did wonder.
The green screen actually is funny. We almost never use the green screen, but the reason we have that there is for sound, just for you, because we thought, with your podcast, let's put some nice, cloth behind us and think of as a big green screen.
Bless you. Well, this is the sort of technical know-how I would expect from YouTubers. So are you YouTubers?
We've become YouTubers.
Oh, no. Hey, man, I'm a YouTuber.
No.
Hey, YouTuber.
You've got, 400-something thousand subscribers on YouTube. You've had over 100 bajillion hits and all your stuff. I mean, you're YouTubers, right? Like, there must be... I say that partly to introduce you to listeners to this who are not familiar with your work. And in fact, before we even get into the YouTuber question, I will start with a confession, because you've been doing Edinburgh for a decade and I've been doing Edinburgh for 25 years and I've never seen you live.
Oh, no way.
I'm familiar with your stuff only from seeing you online.
Mm.
So it kind of, I want to start with an apology because I should have seen you by now, right? I probably skipped your first couple of years for some reason because there's loads of stuff there.
Good call. Then
by the time you were in McEwen Hall, I was like, well, those guys are doing all right. Rejected you on that basis.
I think, but you know what, you never, when you're on at around 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock, you don't get to see anything from... Sure. It takes out like two and a half hours, ten, like you're in the Edinburgh Fringe, you're just kind of, you're either getting ready for your show, snapping, eating,
writing your show.
Yeah.
Because we go with a new show. We don't go with a finished show, we go to a brand new show. So the first 2 weeks of Edinburgh are pure hell as we rewrite the show every afternoon and morning testing it that night.
Because you're YouTubers.
Hey.
That's what right, YouTubers
mate.
Would do.
All right, mate. This podcast is over. Yeah. Hang up the mics. We're out of here.
No, but that is fascinating, and very few people treat it like that. You didn't treat it like that in the early days, presumably. You went there with a finished thing intended to build. We've always done this,
yeah. Which is why we never really feel bad about it. So I think we were talking about it 1 year. We should really get the show like in a polished state for Edinburgh. And then kind of like, well, actually, the audience that came last year kind of saw it as we put it together, and they didn't seem to mind. So that's the kind of precedent we set. So yeah.
Plus, that like, sorry, go on.
Oh no, I was just going to say, like, Edinburgh is so tough and so long. Like, to come out of it with a finished, polished show is amazing, but to go in, I would imagine, and do the same show every night for 26 nights
so
in a row,
boring.
That's like polished, and you know where all the jokes work. That must be
so boring. Yeah. So disappointing. Empty inside.
I love the moments on this show where I can imagine the listeners, pro comics who are listening, thinking, you motherfuckers. Like, it is boring and hard. And that is, I'm surprised to hear that you use it like that. But what an incredibly elegant way to use Edinburgh. What an amazing way. Oh, we'll go to Edinburgh, work up the new show, and presumably work up sketches that then will have a life of their own, either on YouTube as the live video of that sketch, or you'll sell them on your Patreon or whatever on your website, or they will presumably inform and inspire YouTube-only sketches which are shot in your office. So the creativity is like you're using Edinburgh arguably as it should be used, not as the Olympics, but as the workbench.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's not a good way, though. I mean, it's just...
It's very stressful.
It's just... it's a timetable we fell into, and then we had to stick to it because that was the year. Because, you know, you've done Edinburgh, you've done all the writing, it's horrible, and then it's finished. You don't want to do it for another year. But, like, in order to book that trend for ourselves, we would have to do Edinburgh, do it all again, and then when we finish Edinburgh, start writing again. No, thank you.
Yeah, no way.
Yeah,
no,
right.
That's the hard bit.
That's great. So you flipped it, because I see Australian performers at Edinburgh with shows which are really, really ready because they've been at Melbourne or on all the other Australian festivals. Yeah. People have got like different, they approach the calendar in one way. I approached it in like, okay, Edinburgh that's the month of August, that's the finish line. And then I start writing, I have September off, and then I start writing on October the 1st. I don't anymore, but that was like for years I would do that.
Right. Yeah.
And so everyone approaches it with their kind of thing. So let's go back a bit then. So you've got this phenomenal level of success. And I've got to say as well, as someone who hasn't seen you live, I have been loving your online stuff.
Cheers,
Stu. And I would say, and I posted it this morning in the ComCom group, as I've been, you know, kind of researching over the last couple of weeks, One Man Play could have been written for me to enjoy. It like tickles everything in me that I'm like, oh God, oh my fucking God, this is written for me. It's like Inception. And I want to we'll get into some of that as kind of like a motif of like, we'll unpack that in a bit. I had a really interesting listener question. The listener's going mad, going, oh, finally, you know, been recommending you for a long time. I had a really interesting listener question that might be a good place to start, which is from Sandra Hayes, who says, I'm really interested in whether they think coming from a scientific background rather than an arts background has shaped the way they approach their comedy. Also, watch Arms get upset at the notion of Foyle's architecture background being considered scientific.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that in a second. Yes, I suppose artsy. I approach it from an arts and a scientific background.
Unbelievable.
With my 2 degrees in science
this
and
is
architecture.
Such bullshit.
And
so,
the lowly scientist over here. I didn't mean that. It was a slip of the tongue.
So, this is like, this used to actually annoy me. Now I find it funny. But he did architecture, and after 3 years, they handed him a science diploma, right?
No, it's actually a degree.
He says
higher
level
degree.
I've never seen the paper.
You did. I brought it in once.
Did you bring it in?
Oh my God. Do you know what made it worse? Is because, so basically, architecture was like a 5-year course. After 3 years, a lot of people don't want to do it, so they give you a degree so that you can go off and do something else, but at least you haven't wasted your 3 years. Well, you can't have because it's a science degree, but still, look, it doesn't matter. No, they gave me this, so I no use for this degree. I was going to finish architecture anyway. So I went looking for this degree to prove to Arms that it was a proper science degree. And I dug around, I was trying to find, like, where did I keep it? Where
you
was it?
You vindictive bastard.
I found it in a drawer, right? And it was rolled up, but holding the scroll in place was a baby's rattle. Like a circular part of a baby's rattle that we used for a sketch called Professional Babies was put around the scroll to hold. That's how little I thought of it. I had a baby's rattle keeping my science degree
fair
safe.
Means to attack each other aside. So the question was, is the scientific background rather than arts background, has that shaped it? Because one of the things
I think
one of like the kind of opening observations I would make about what you do is it's clean as a whistle. You're such an efficient three-hander sketch show. Like if you look at kind of the last 10 years, you've been going there for 10 or 11 years. Well, not that it happened, but you know, it was 11 years ago you started doing Edinburgh. And to be the powerhouse that you are now, like everything must have worked to get you to where you are now. You've got these incredibly clean, organized aesthetics. You are using the festival to write stuff that to complement the YouTube channel. It's all growing and building and building, and now must be at a kind of escape velocity, I would imagine. And that it seems to me like what might differentiate you from other three or four hander sketch groups that I've seen is you don't kind of have that, God, we're all a bit of a disaster and that's the joke tone. Do you know what I mean? What you have is a really clean, certainly in the stuff I've seen, a really clean, rehearsed, slick kind of aesthetic. And I'm wondering, and as well, I would imagine that's emblematic of the kind of operating system. Now, tell me I'm wrong. Maybe you're just fucking about and you've been fucking about for so long it's become
It's funny, like, you say, like, it's all a bit of disaster and that's the joke. Like, like, do you know what? Like, they are amazing moments when they're authentic, you know? Mm. And it's about creating an environment where that can happen authentically, you know, that you're not trying to... So, yeah, the stuff is the... I guess we're talking about the live show now. Like, the scripts are really written and they become tight as a drum. And then they become too tight and the joy kind of just starts to kind of leave them a little bit. So you have to leave unstructured areas in those scripts where you can improvise. And with improvisation, anything can happen.
Well, I'm usually a bit of a disaster anyway.
Yeah, but
especially when it comes to the set list. So, you know, if ever there's any mistakes happening, it'll be me with the set list, especially at Edinburgh, when the set list is fresh and the sketches are in a certain order. And I don't know what that order is. And I just can't seem to remember.
Yeah. I gave up trying.
Yeah, I gave up trying 8 years ago. And then it just, you know, the show is new and you just see this pause. You see me looking around. If you're sharp, you can see me looking around, looking for cues as to what the next sketch
is when there's one that you have to start and look at you. We can't do anything to help you, so we're gone. And you're standing there kind of looking, and then oh no, am I like, and then yeah. Then you have to kind of change character, but it's just so like in front of everyone's eyes, the magic is completely lost. Yeah. As you try to,
yeah.
But you kind of absorb that quality of Hogs, who I believe is one of the Shauns.
Yeah,
like we'll get into the names in a minute. I mean, in a minute I'll ask you to introduce yourself, but we'll get to that. But you've factored that in. So it's like, because through constant repetition of year after year after year, you know how each other work, right?
Definitely. We the three of us have each characteristics that we know what we can play to on stage for sure.
With Sean sort of being more the kind of fatherly sort of steward at times. But
yeah,
we all go in and out of each role.
So
like, you know.
Yeah, so it keeps it interesting for ourselves and for the audience as well. So
but there's definitely
So you mean, I thought you meant you swap around the roles within sketches. You just mean like you kind of in the building of it. So I do understand.
No, yeah, just I suppose when it goes off the rails, like normally I would slip into the person who's trying to, you know, bring it back onto the just naturally, you know, like just trying to get us back. And then Hog is all over the place and then Arms is maybe somewhere in between. It's kind of what the names are, like you were gonna ask in a second anyway. Foil, comedic foil, arms and legs, clumsy, hog's the limelight. It's kind of these stereotypes that we naturally play, but then sometimes I can go off the rails and the lads have to bring me back or vice versa. But I suppose naturally what we sit into when it goes off the rail.
Statistically yes. Yes. Yeah. From an engineering point of
and
view.
As we all know, comedy is all about
statistics. Hitting the marks.
And so right. Just coming back to that educational thing, that scientific background, do you think, is there any merit in that observation?
Definitely.
Oh, I think I think you only mentioned there the other day, I don't know if you've seen the movie Moneyball, Stuart.
Oh, yes.
Tell me exactly what you're going to say, because I feel like I know. Great.
Yeah, so Fingo here, Foyle here, said, I'd love to have the statistics, you know, from all the gigs that we've done, you know, the laughs per minute.
It was you too, we've all talked about it, only
Foyle came up with a really funny way to say it.
Oh, right, okay.
in the Moneyball metaphor. But he was just for looking for those statistics of, like, you know, the laughs per minute, the jokes per sentence,
what sketches what get what laughs, yeah, and to what degree, do we get a belly laugh, do we get a little laugh, do we get a
and the decibel level of the laughs per head as well, of course.
But you know that I was saying to you before that I was reading in one of the Marx Brothers autobiographies, Harpo Marx wrote that their manager or their mother, I think, the early years, whatever, would stand at the back of the theatre and have a list of every single gag in the show and the live show, and then would give it a tick, no laugh, medium laugh, big laugh. And so at the end of the show, they would have, right, how did the show go? And everyone has their different perceptions, obviously, including the person who's marked it. Mm. But at least they can go, well, hang on, that got a big laugh 3 nights in a row. Look, 3 big ticks.
Yeah. Mm.
Yes. You know, I don't know, like, there's something in that, I guess. But you, of course, people just do that, but they do it in their head. But oftentimes, that's what the benefit of having three people is, because go... your Foyle says, oh, I didn't think that worked really well. And I go, actually, I thought it worked really well. And then Hogg says, oh, it didn't work well at all. Back to square one.
Yeah, you do find that. You're like, wait a minute, what room was I in?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, God, I felt like I was dying on my hole out there on that particular line or whatever. Yeah. And then you were like, no, they were loving that. Like, oh.
Well, usually the person who says the joke is the opinion that trumps.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? If it's a stalemate, because
you're embodying it.
You still have to trust that feeling. Yeah. Did you feel happy when you said this joke and they responded? Or did you feel sad?
Are you prepared to put yourself through saying that joke over and over again?
Yeah, yeah.
On the basis of two of your friends saying it's good as you die.
Yeah, it's like we used to equate it, like, you know, you're sending me over the top with, like, a gun with no bullets, or, you know, you're sending me over the top with a spear against a Gatling gun with that joke.
Well, yeah, that's interesting that way. Sorry.
Oh, no, I was just saying, like, just on that kind of science thing, it must be so much easier for three people to analyse a show, because there's three eyes looking at it with a lot on the plate.
Yeah, yeah. There's not much room for being delusional.
Yeah, I don't know how, like, you know, it must be very hard as a stand-up. Like, if I had to analyse all the sketches just myself, it'd be very different outcomes.
Well, all you have to do is to look at a first draft of a sketch that we write where you think, you know, or any one of us thinks, oh, this is really funny. And then someone else comes in and goes, yeah, but that makes no sense. That just shouldn't go there. That needs to go up here. And we need to slightly change the premise. And then it's a way better sketch. And you think to yourself, if I was on my own, the draft one would have been the one that we went with.
Because you can't get out of your own head. That's what I always wonder about a stand-up and the right material. Yeah, when you have it on the page, you wrote it, you think it's great. And it's very, very difficult to step back from that material and be critical as to why maybe it's not working.
Yeah.
Whereas in the office, you get to come in and present it, and as you read it out, you realise that the other two people aren't laughing, and perhaps it isn't actually as funny as you previously thought it was.
Every day you go through the experience, if you're writing in a group, of, like, you go through a sketch, and some jokes make the grade and some make the cut at the end of the day, and some don't. And then every 10 minutes you go, oh, no, that joke is really good. No, that's just my joke. That's my joke. It's not really good. It's just my joke. That's why I really like the joke. And you gotta, like, you just gotta like pepper it. You know, you gotta pinch of salt your own jokes each time.
Yeah. Mm.
So with regard to that, with regard to the writing, is that a pretty well-oiled machine now, writing? How has the way that you write as a three changed over the last 10 or 11 years?
It's very...
Oh, God, it always gets better. We still have so much...
We're still learning. Like,
still learning, yeah. But God, compared to where we were even last year.
There's no kind of, like, the good thing about now is that there's no fear anymore. Like, we're not worried that there will be nothing. You know, we start a writing session, I know with 100% certainty that at the end of it we'll have something that we can film. You know, whereas years ago, at the back of your mind, you're looking at the clock, you're going, 3 o'clock, 3:30, we need something by 5, we're not going to make it, you know, and then you start to panic and you go, no, this is the script that we have to keep now. You know, there was that sort of thing. Whereas now you just kind of, like, last night, this is not a regular occurrence, to be fair, but last night we had a script that we had to bin at 4:20. And we just pulled out another idea and started working on it for about an hour, and that's what we're going to do today.
Because we're such legends.
No, yeah. Yeah, because we're such legends.
Yeah.
But years ago, we would have stayed stuck in stuff way longer.
Stuck in it, yeah.
And part of it was going over to Second City in Chicago and doing like a week-long course there, which really helped us realize that there's a language to talk about sketches and about sketch writing and the types of sketches that you're doing and maybe why they aren't working and what type of sketch they are and how they're crafted. Mm. And along with that, that kind of opened our heads up to, oh my God, a language. We can say, like, it's on game. This joke is on the game. That's off the game. You're not hitting the premise strong enough. You are hitting the premise. This is more character-based. This is more gag-based. This is going to flow because it's topical. This isn't, but it's character and it's fun. And then we've developed our own language.
Of our own, yeah.
Of our own, yeah, alongside that.
A verbal shorthand or something.
Yeah.
So this is Foil Arms and Hog. What a joy. Loads of more stuff to come from them. We're going to talk about punchline density, data science. I mean, I'm going to talk about data science, but I don't know that we're particularly going to get into it, because their approach to SEO and titling, given the enormous crowd they have on YouTube, is admirably lazy. So a bit more on that coming up. We'll talk about the differences between online audiences. We'll find out the coincidental sort of accidental thievery, the parallel thinking that led them to obsessively Google to check sketches haven't been done before. That sounds very painful. We'll talk about Black Wednesday at the Fringe and how they use the Fringe in the unique way in which they do. And we will also, and I should have said this at the very beginning, there's a thing they say at the end of this, which is so wonderful. It's to do with pooling their personal ambitions collectively. And it sort of is a big part, I guess, of how they maintain the core stability of the group. And it's emblematic of just how lovely they are. It's such a great thing. Now, that is that's all of that. Listen, there's 40 minutes. 40 minutes is great extras on this one. I nearly put it out as a two-parter, and I thought, no, reward the insiders for their faithful patronage. So if you have joined up, and if you haven't yet, you can at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. Not only will you get ad-free episodes, but also 40 minutes of extras from the lads, including The Matrix, The Swan Dive, Chris Rocking, and a bunch of other of their sort of personalised DIY sketch terms, such that they can work very cleanly and efficiently and know exactly what each other means. That is all great stuff. Plus, there have been some cracking extras recently. Adam Rowe, we had extras from Jonathan Coulton, we had extras from Finn Taylor. There's some just belting stuff up there, and hundreds of hours, all of which you can enjoy for a minimum £2 a month or as much as you would like to spend. Right, just before we get back to Foil Arms and Hog, if you are in Bristol or the Southwest, every Tuesday night now we're running Chops at Friendly Records in Bedminster. I was going to tell you about the brilliant show we've got with Alistair Beckett King, but it's already sold out because it does already sell out. We keep the headliner secret, and I shouldn't have told you, but it's sold out, so it doesn't matter. But there's some fantastic headliners coming up there. And also, myself and Catherine Bohart on the 8th of December are going to be in the Rivington, what is it called? The Rivington Room in Shoreditch Town Hall, you know, where they do ARG. Or they did do ARG back in the day. I hope they still do ARG. You can come and see us both. It's only 60 capacity. It's selling pretty well. Bohart's new stuff is absolutely on fire. Mine is some wet sticks because it doesn't exist. I've got three bits because I did the thing I'm not supposed to talk about, and I burnt all of the existing material. I've got three good bits for next year. And, I mean, it's £12, £10 concessions. She's worth all of that, but I will do my best to give you £6 worth of value. So it'd be lovely to sell that out Wednesday, the 8th of December in Shoreditch Town Hall. And some other general bits and bobs coming up. But then we kind of get into Christmas gig mode. There's a last chance if you are if you're listening to this and you're thinking, God, I haven't sorted out the Christmas party. What on earth are we going to do? We're working virtually. You can book the virtual office party. I'm only realizing now I should have been really bigging this up on the podcast for the last few months. I've done all the annals and avenues I can, and I wasted £400 on some LinkedIn advertising. I should have just told you about it more. The other thing is the resilience stuff is going tremendously well, and if you're planning any kind of January kickstart for your team, or you suspect that your management might be, get in touch. Have a look at stuartgoldsmith.com. And you can find out all about that under the tab marked Speaking. I've had a few of those booked in for January, which is an enormous financial relief to me. And also, it made me go, oh yeah, of course, this is a great thing to kick the year off. So if you're in the mood for one of them, tuck in. Let's get back to Foil Arms and Hog.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Why do you think that is? That they? What's your theory on why there is such a difference in the time of the crafting time for something like?
I'll tell you what, it's because stage stuff needs to be funnier.
Oh, the standard, yes.
The standard needs to be much higher. You need to have a whole room of live people laughing at it all the time.
Every single joke.
Whereas a video can find its own audience. It can go off. If someone didn't find it funny, you know, they probably just won't have watched it. They won't have clicked on it because they probably won't have liked. They know they won't have. They're not going to like it. Yeah. So yes. They're not there.
Also, style of delivery. You can the pace of a live sketch. You can make it, or sorry, a film sketch. You can force the pace because you can jump cut very quickly. Or that didn't work. We can skip over that and we can jump to that scene. Now we can fix it in the edit.
So you have more tools at your disposal.
You can go in super close and deliver a quiet line, funny. Whereas on stage, everything has to be pretty much of a volume. The pace is dictated. That's it. It is what it is.
Yes.
If a joke
falls flat on a video, people will probably keep watching. But there'll only be one person in that room. They won't find it awkward that they didn't find that funny. Mm-hmm. But if there's a whole room of people didn't laugh at a certain line, everyone will notice.
Yeah.
And that will...
I can see you beside me and you didn't laugh.
Yeah.
And I didn't.
Yes, that's a good observation.
They're not funny.
Right.
Yeah. And that might snowball. You know, you've lost momentum there.
Yeah. And I just want to look back for a second on the content of the videos. They are punchline dense videos. I don't want anyone listening to this who is less familiar with your online work to imagine that when you say, oh, you know, the live stuff has to be stronger, that the videos are in any way not strong. I mean, the punchline density is phenomenal.
Oh, thanks.
One of the things I love about your stuff is that you seem to, and again, maybe it's the sort of scientific process angle. And I do think that probably the biggest, I won't say YouTuber, but biggest comic who is also on YouTube and who's been on this show is Nigel Ung, who has a background in data science. You know, he does the Uncle Roger character, which has just gone absolutely bananas. He's got millions and millions of subscribers. Yeah. His background is in data science, so he's very, very specifically checking out all of the metrics, what happens this time of day. You know, he's built the whole system himself and kind of researched it. He's done exactly what he is the Moneyball guy. 100%. So when he was talked about in this interview, when he got a particular viral hit, everyone on YouTube went to the rest of his channel to check it out, and everything there was completely prepped to go viral. So then it kicked it into the algorithm, and suddenly it went bananas. Anyway, you should talk to him.
We should.
We
don't really play that game. We kind of get to the video, and we're like, there's the video, we really like it. And then we're definitely much more lax on the promotion and tagging
even
of
the
it.
Title of it. I mean, sometimes we're a bit better than we were maybe even last year, but sometimes it's the title of it or the marketing of it. We add that at the very last minute. Yeah. And there's 2 minutes thought gone into it.
Yeah.
That seems strange to me, given how hard, you're really hard workers. You edit hard, you write hard. I want to come back to the writing and the editing and the relationship between those in a second. But that does seem strange to me, because from the outside, it looks like you've experimented, you're on the case, and you are knocking out, these videos are being seen by hundreds of thousands of people. Like, your audience online is greater, one would imagine, than the amount of people who've ever, or maybe will ever, see you live.
True, definitely. Yeah.
So is there something, it seems odd to me that, does it feel to you like that's kind of a blind spot in your process, that you aren't really on top of the tagging and the titling and all the rest of it. Like if someone said, if I was a, you know, a YouTube masterclass guy and I was like, oh no, you could 10x the number of views you get if you did that. Isn't that worth a course for a week, like going to Second City?
Or does it like not? It should be. It's probably because we're railing naturally against what everyone thinks we are. The YouTuber, and we don't really think of ourselves like we are way better at stage than we are at film, but everybody knows us
better. What metric is that? Because if you look at the amount of, like, is it your enjoyment of it? Is that the difference?
More skilled, I think.
Skilled, more imaginative, more
like I think we're at a high level on stage, and I think the videos, a lot of people can make funny videos. I mean, not many people can do it every single week, which is tough, but that's just hard work, you know what I mean? But like, it's taken us a lot of time on stage to get to where we are at and to get that level of performance. And I just think it's easier to get good at videos quicker.
Definitely.
So there's a couple of things you've mentioned there. One is it's maybe less meaningful to you to be really good at videos because you think that's less hard won. One of the things is maybe your enjoyment of it. There's got to be no relationship between 1,000 people going bananas at a joke you've just improvised in live in a room and you pressing send or whatever. on the upload. There's no difference there. But then what are the other kind of balls in the air there? What are the other kind of aspects of that? Because when I say, what do you mean by better? There's personally satisfying. There's how much money it makes. There's how many people see it. And all of those things exist in their own kind of context of, like you said, you know, if you don't want to be seen as YouTubers, what's that about? Because you are YouTubers, right?
I think it could be pretentiousness as well. Could be creeping into it. Do you know what I mean? Like we want to create a funny video, and that's where, like, it's about the funny, the comedy of it all. And then someone's like, well, have you really thought about the tagging and the promotion of it? That's not for me to think about.
Which is dumb. Yeah,
I've created the, which is from a work point of view,
it should
speak
for itself.
Yeah, yeah.
And it should go viral on its own accord.
We're a bit better than that now. We've kind of figured out it's funny because we have a US immigration video that we did, and it went, it was one of our first big viral hits,
especially
in the States. And it's like a good, you know, we just kind of went, oh, that's pretty funny. And then I think 2 years later, we did a UK immigration one, and then we stopped. And that was like 3 years ago.
Yeah, the UK immigration was the same sketch, just like we kept everything the same. Yeah. It was like we'd found a structure for a sketch.
Well, we never came back to it. Like, and then 3 years later, this year, we were like, oh my God, why have we not done any other countries in this? Like, this was a hit machine. Why did we stop? And I don't know, we just didn't think of it. We just honestly didn't think of it.
And then we've done four more absolute belters in
this
the same
year
format.
Or something, like this, between this year and last
German
year.
Immigration,
so
Russian
funny.
Immigration,
that
Irish immigration.
That was
going
to be one of my questions, was about you finding a format. I have to say, I didn't look at the dates on those. So my assumption was you did the USA one, it went bananas, and you went, great, we've got something. Come on, lads, rub hands together.
Idiots, like fools, wandering around the office. What can we watch?
Well, was there within that feeling, was there that sort of resistance that we're exploring about resistance to being thought of as a YouTube person? Is there some element of that? Is that maybe what made you either hesitant to repeat it, or like, what I'm saying is, was there a bit of you that was like, well, that's gone massive, but if we just do that again, that's the sort of thing a YouTuber would do?
Well, I think the two lads probably have a little more integrity than I do. I'd be a little bit more on the naff side of things than about what I'd be willing to put up with, maybe, do you know? Whereas I'd be happy to take on the title of YouTuber, because whatever, I'm a YouTuber, it's a YouTuber, do you know what I mean? I wouldn't like to be like screamed in my face on a night out, you fucking YouTuber, fuck off. but it is what it is, like, do you know what I mean? And we make a bit of a living out of it, so, you know.
And presumably, if you did, like, is there, now listen, I've got to be gentle, because my instinct is always like, oh, there's a crack there, they disagree on something.
Let's get into that.
I don't want to break you guys up. Yeah. But I'm interested in that, because presumably, Flango, I'm just going to address you, I guess that you're Flango from the base of this. It's very difficult. I'm sat there with like a logic problem going, okay, arms must be that one. And short, one of the
you're doing very well.
We should have sat in order for
you. I've written it down. But presumably, if that interests you, one of the interests there is, hey, the thing, all of the YouTube content could have an extra zero on it. Like it could be bigger if you nailed that stuff down. Presumably, that might make a difference financially. It might make a difference to how many tickets you sell, how much merch you sell, and those are all things that you like. So I'm just wondering, like, if I was in your position, why would I not? And arguably, I am in a microcosm of your position. I've got a podcast. I don't bother putting clips on YouTube. I don't get around to it. Part of the reason I don't get around to it is I look down on it because I'm in my 40s and I grew up with people who were into live comedy. Those are my influences. I'm not aspiring to be like people who make stuff on YouTube. Mm. Is that part of it?
Yeah, I don't know. If someone ever said we were an influencer, I think that'd be too much to tell.
Because you associate that with kind of vapidity.
That's even too nasty for me. We're
content creators, is what I think.
You are content creators, and if that makes your skin crawl, I'm interested in why.
I love you.
You get lumped into a big barrel of stuff, and don't, like, some content creators are amazing, and some of them are really not. And unfortunately, it's too broad a term to cover everyone.
Yeah, because we work so hard making the weekly videos, and then you see someone who puts out 4 videos in a week and gets more views, but they've just, you know.
But what they've done is lazy.
Some of them, yeah. And then that's like, then you're being compared to them. You're like, no, but we haven't done that though.
And then there's people who cash in real early, which we didn't, or yet to do so, you know, in many respects. Like we didn't monetize anything for a long time.
We still don't have mid-roll ads because they interfere with watching the video. But then you have people predicting your income from YouTube based on all these ads that we don't have turned on our channel. And you're like, no, we're not
full on that. Network.
You're like, what are you talking about?
What did they look that up before? And it was like somewhere, but they had a range. It was like hilarious. Like Full Amazon Hog net worth somewhere between, it's like per month, 100 and 100,000 euros. Wow, what a scale. Yeah.
That's it. That's interesting. When you talk about influencers, and yes, so that is too large, because I think the way you see yourselves is that, and totally justifiably, is that you are live comedy performers who document what you do and put it online.
I would say live comedy performers who have now gotten decent-ish, hopefully at short form comedy.
Yeah, to us it's just like a new, it's almost like a TV show that goes out every Thursday at 8 a.m. It's like a sketch show, you know. They're not really commissioning sketch shows anymore, but yeah, this is the new way people watch sketch comedy, and it is. Like, there's amazing sketch comedians up there. There's a lot of, you know, one person, one phone, and that can be absolutely brilliant and some hilarious, you know. And that's just the new medium is, and people have to get used to that. Like,
When you said, like, you know, the Thursday morning at 8 o'clock, that's at 8 a.m. This is another example of how, like, I don't know, are you just stubborn about it, or just we just don't want to play the game of, like, that is not the best time for us to put out our video. That's probably one of the worst times we could put out a video. And if we really, like, crunched the numbers and looked at our fans and when they want to watch it, we would have it. But we have kept that up for 6-7
screwed
years.
Screwed the Americans over for no reason.
But we're just like, we're sticking to Thursday at 8 a.m. If you like our comedy, you can watch it.
We should probably switch it, yeah.
I don't know.
And what is that? Well, what is that? You say, I don't know, but, like, is that central to your idea of your integrity? Like, we're doing, you know, because switching it would be something a YouTuber does, chasing metrics, chasing algorithmic boosts and what have you.
That's probably out of fear that if you change it, you might lose, you know, you might lose your audience.
A little bit.
Certainly it was for me.
Consistency has probably helped us.
It definitely does.
We have been so stubborn in the past, and a lot of times it's paid off. Just powering through. We're just gonna do our thing, and our audience will find us and go against kind of the recommended stuff.
Oh, we did that for Edinburgh for years, wasn't it? They kept trying to get us to get PR and play the PR game and get reviewers in, and we just ignored it.
Yeah.
Or get a big production company to produce your show.
We stopped giving free tickets to reviewers to our shows. We're like, no, it's selling well. They don't get a ticket. Which yeah. like, and everyone's like, "What do you do?" We're like, no,
I don't care.
So stubborn. Yeah. Maybe that's what we were learning on this podcast.
I think we, determined and stubborn. The two sides of the same coin, really.
Yeah,
aren't they?
Yeah.
I tell you what does dictate though the flow, where we are like totally vulnerable to the gods of the algorithm though sometimes, because there was a couple of years back there, Facebook changed their algorithm, and they changed it briefly in our favor. Where all our videos were getting consistently a lot more hits than
it's like doubled
hits.
Over an iPhone.
Double, like, and then we were living off that for a while, and we were like, this is great, we're increasing our audience. And the algorithm, they change something again. Of course, they don't tell you what they change about the algorithm. They keep that very in-house. And then all of a sudden it got very difficult again. Better videos, these are funnier videos, not doing as well, with a bigger audience. We're like, oh, they've done this time, and then they keep changing it, so you never know what's going
to
happen.
That's probably another reason we don't respect the videos as much as the live show, because in a live show, to make an audience laugh, you know, even if you're a huge comedian going into your fans, it still has to be funny. But online videos are flippant. You could get like, we have videos with, like, you know, millions of views that we're like, yeah, that was decent, but the one last week was probably funnier, but that has hardly any of the views. So there's, it doesn't quite equate to...
That is really fascinating, because it must be seductive to think, well, this one's got 10 million views, therefore it's our best sketch.
Yeah.
You'd be forgiven
for
thinking
but
that.
It's not.
No. It's just a topical thing. Like, you happen to do a sketch on, you know, the World Cup, when the World Cup is on, and then everyone's searching World Cup.
Yeah, and the YouTube engine will pick up on that and goes, yes, people want to look at World Cup now. We're going to show your video to everybody. Your crappy, like, thrown together comedy video of the World Cup with one gag in it.
It was really good, okay?
Is that frustrating, the fact that you've got... I mean, in many ways, it's a sort of, it's a blessing that comedians working in the 90s couldn't have dreamt of, that there's, you can make a thing, you upload it to the internet, and then everyone can see it. Like, it's an incredible gift, but also it's not one that you're in control of. It's one that they frequently deliberately change the algorithm to stop people gaming it, and it's all kind of opaque, and you don't know what the thing is. Is that a frustration?
No, we can't just get on with it, really.
Well,
to be honest,
maybe because our fan base online has built up so much over the years, because we've just kept at it, and now we kind of have a set level of fans who always watch each week. So even if a video for us kind of doesn't do very well, it's still getting an awful lot of views because it's still reaching our fans and they're still watching it, which is lovely. That's the funny thing.
Staying power.
If you're looking at the comments come in, you're going to get updates on the comments. If you see negative comments come in about your video, to us, that just means the video is doing really well, because it's spreading past our fan base.
Discovering it past
it's got to the crazies.
It's hit crazies.
Yeah,
that's
lovely.
When the money starts rolling in.
So what is the... I know this might not be an answerable question, but what is the video of yours that you consider to be of the highest quality that has done the least well?
Oh, interesting.
Oh, great question.
There's a few. I mean, didn't we always... this is probably not the one that we think is the best quality, but one that we thought didn't get as much as it deserved was, you know, the interview at Winter. We brought that up last year.
Yeah,
we were talking about it.
Yeah,
we thought
it
was really funny.
Yeah.
This is a radio... It's called an interview with Winter, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a radio host doing an interview with Winter. We've just personified the season. And
it just has so many jokes in it that really make me laugh. And I look at it the odd time and it still gives me a laugh. Like,
yeah. But people didn't like
that argument where they're having over it. Like, you know, he's got the book and it's like 10 great things about Winter. And it's still a stupid little joke on a forward by Autumn.
Yeah.
And it's so stupid. You can only just see it written. You don't even mention it. And then inside it's just like he's listing soups. And then your man goes, soups? He's like, yeah, soups are traditionally winter. And then the interviewers or the journalist is like, what about gazpacho? And he's like, well, I wouldn't consider that a soup. Well, I mean, it is a soup. And then there's this like improvised conversation we had with, well, you know, it's and he's saying, Foyle is saying, well, it's runny, it's not thick. And I'm like, well, it's got croutons. And they're kind of coming over each other, so you can just pick out the bits as it goes through, and then there's just this awkward pause. It's like, okay, we'll just park that, you know.
But we loved it. And then we do, like, every Christmas, because, you know, we're taking the week off, we put out a pre-recorded thing of our top 10 favourite sketches from that year. And even when we introduced it, we were like, okay, we know that not many people like this sketch, but we're putting it in because it's one of our favourites. So here it is. Watch it this time. Watch it properly.
It is actually really empowering doing that list, because I remember we did it last year. Like, this is our top 10 sketches. This isn't your top 10. This isn't the ones that got the most hits. This is our top 10. So if you don't like that, you know, watch something else.
Yeah. I like that's interesting. I've seen a few of those. I saw that like top 10 of the last decade kind of thing. And I'm interested in the fact that you're like, just what is that feeling for you that like it's not your top 10? Like, do you, that suggests that there is an element of their top 10 that suggests friction, right? Like, might have thought, oh, that one's still doing really well. Fucking idiots. Do you know what I mean? because you're kind of overreaching artistic, not overreaching, but you're like, with the example of the winter and autumn sketch, that is, I really like that. It sounds funny, but it sounds kind of subtle and nuanced. And I think maybe some of your stuff that does best is punchy and immediate and very funny and very quick and dense, like punchline dense. But like those things are almost like, you know, like a joke on The Simpsons. There'll be some jokes that are like big in your face jokes. And there'll be some jokes which are just lovely little details that you maybe wouldn't even notice were jokes. Do you know what I mean? This has a different feeling to it.
Yeah, I suppose it's all about the big fat middle, isn't it? The bell curve of what people are going to what people can relate to, what the most people will laugh at an average laugh, and then, you know, a slightly more subtle joke where people will laugh more at it because they've found themselves more intelligent to get this more subtler joke, so they reward themselves with a bigger laugh. And then there's the other side where you've given them too much information on the joke and it's not as funny because now you've lost the big fat middle.
Yeah, there's no puzzle for them to work out.
I think we know it ourselves, don't we? We put out a sketch and we go, that's going to get views because it's topical, it's, you know, quite a popular, and like you say, it's punchy. And then sometimes we do a few of them in a row and we're like, that's okay. We can do a character based kind of
character
that's quite silly we're into a bit more.
There was one there quite recently, and it wasn't the winter one. It was much more recently where we were quite disappointed. We were like, it wasn't my baby. I think it was like either your script or your script, Finch, and we were like, that was funny. That deserved a lot more, and it died in its hoop.
Was it
relatively speaking,
the football chanting one? Was that
No, it wasn't that one.
Well, actually, well, that one though. Yeah, well, that yes. That probably is what I'm thinking of, yes. That was a lot funnier than it got credit for.
Yeah, true.
But it might have just been because it was sport that kind of alienated maybe some people, I don't know.
Do you know what it could be as well? Like, you'll know this, definitely, like, any comedian who watches comedy, you know, you have your taste. When you see a comedian do something in particular that, like, you get in on, like, that's your buzz, as opposed to maybe a general audience member's buzz. And I think maybe that's what... there's certain sketches that we get a much bigger kick out of. Yeah. Like, the ones that are quite punchy... are easier to write, I guess. And you can see the strings a little bit as a comedian, you know, like, you know, sure. Oh, this is how it works together. But the ones that are more character-based and, like, say, more subtle, they're the ones like, oh, we made that work. Well, that was quite skilled to get that going. Oh, yeah.
It was the card sketch.
The cards?
The top trumps.
The card shop.
The card shop was funny.
It was really, really funny. And I watched it and I was editing it. I never laugh at the edit.
Yeah. Mm.
And I was laughing while I was editing it. Mm. And I mean, we knew when we were doing it, was like, this is a sketch about a card shop. What is it even called? You know, what can we call this that would make people watch this?
Yeah.
Because we're getting a bit better at that, like I said. We're like, you know, was like, oh, the card shop that has a greeting card for literally every occasion. It's like, that kind of sounds mildly interesting. So we went with that. But yeah, like...
no one's going to,
its relatability is quite low.
Yeah, it's not relatable. Yeah. It's not topical. So you're already... You've lost two things.
More surreal our sketch is going to be, probably going to be more funny for comedians. And people who like comedy.
Yeah.
The more surreal it is, the less hits it's going to get. The more relatable it is, the more punchy it is, the more viral it's going
to
be.
But also, I don't have any proof to back this up, so this is just a hunch, but I know who killed JFK. No. Sorry. But I think the character-based ones that are more subtle or whatever, they like retain your audience and they get your audience to like you. They're more likely to buy tickets to your show and to go, like, this is my jam. Whereas, like, you know, the punchy, like, really viral or topical ones, that just reaches a bigger audience, and that's, like, cast in the net wide.
They're consumed
in
a second.
Drags them in, and then you pummel them to death with your character sketches.
Yeah, which are actually meaty, funny
sketches.
Yeah,
funny. And this is something I'd like to see maybe in real life, you know, that separates you from the other kind of...
Yeah, you want more of the character stuff, whereas the punchy stuff, well, someone else has done a punchy thing, you can go and watch next.
We did Vegetables Throws a Party.
Oh my God.
And at this point, Stuart, we were like, really?
Vegetables.
We're doing a sketch called Vegetable Throws a Party.
That was like a head in hands moment.
We were dressing up, like I was dressing up in red, full red, with like a red beret to play a tomato. You know,
like, is this the moment like in the documentary where they lost their way?
Yeah. So this is after the success of the rooms in your house throw a party.
Yes, which became really
iconoclastic and unusual and funny. And you're like, great, throws a party. Let's do other things.
Yeah, that was nice. It straddled both worlds of being kind of very relatable because everyone's got our rooms in their house, and then surreal and kind of weird as well. So it's kind of like, funny in that way, that it kind of had a bit of integrity about it, as opposed to vegetables throws a party.
Like, we actually had a conversation in the middle of, we're all dressed up as different vegetables, so we're looking at the script, we're like, okay, we better leave the joke in about the aubergine like being kind of like a penis in tech speak, because otherwise this could be CBeebies. You know, we have to put in some slightly adult jokes in this.
We were in tears.
It took us 2 days to film, so it was an extra day's shoot to do a script that we weren't mad on. We knew it had funny bits on it, but we weren't fully behind. And then it just came together in the edit and...
people loved it.
But I love it as well now. Like, it's so silly.
Well, I knew it would be big. I knew it would be big because...
It was your idea.
8 billion people know what vegetables are. So there you go. There's your relatability. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So Flango is the populist voice, right?
Yeah.
That may denigrate him a bit, but you've got a better idea.
That's a compliment for doing this job.
No slight on your comic ability, I guess.
To
identify the hits. Yeah.
That's good.
8 billion people know what a vegetable is. I mean, that's a compelling argument, right?
Yeah, it is.
So the days of the week have a party. You know, that was yours as well. You know, everyone knows the days of the week.
The more and more I've been thinking about it recently is just relatability. But if someone can relate to it, then.
But true, but like a friend of my mother said, which was kind of interesting. I always listen to the older generation when they like your sketch. It usually means that it's good because to reach them, I think is the hardest. But she said, like, when I saw it was vegetables, I thought, how can you make vegetables funny? You know, how? And like, that's the challenge, though. If you're doing something that's really relatable, then it's way harder to find that point that makes it unique, original, and funny.
Mm.
That's much more difficult.
Well, certainly original, because if it's universal, then
100%.
There's 8 billion people who could have thought of the idea before you. Maybe less comedians, but at least maybe 1 million comedians.
Oh, there's a lot of time you come into it. If someone has like an idea that sounds like a really great idea, but it's like very simple sketch premise, but brilliant, you know. We all just have to go off and Google to make sure no one has done it before, you know, because you're like, there's so many people out there.
It's a terrifying Google.
Yeah. Awful. And you don't want to be the guy who finds it as well. No. Yeah. If it's not your idea, you don't like, I've got some bad news here.
Then you watch and you're like, oh, well, I thought we would have done a better job than that. Oh, no, but we still can't do it now either way.
And a lot of the time we go, we could have done a better job than that.
Well, you're competing with people who just film on their phones as well. So it's a race against time.
Against the democratized creativity of everyone in the world.
Exactly. But in fairness, I think there are only certain types of ideas, and we don't actually come across them.
Oh my god! Do you remember once we had this wood sketch? Just like, we didn't Google it to check. We probably wouldn't have found this anyway. It was about we were trying to play off. Artists being asked to do things for experience. You know, we won't pay you, but we'll do. You can get experience.
Exposure.
And so this premise of the thing was, a plumber comes out to fix a leaky tap for this guy, and the guy at the end, the plumber's looking for the money, and the guy's like, "No, well, I'll pay you an exposure," and it's like taking snaps, and the plumber's going, "No." Simple premise, you know. Anyway, we do it, and then we get a few like people going, "Oh, you just stole this video off the Italian sketch group." I was like, "What?"
Well, we get emails from people going, "Like, I really love your stuff. You don't need to take ideas from other groups. You're good enough on your own."
And we're like, "What is going on?"
Like, forgive you for stealing, but you're definitely thieves.
So we go on, and they send us the link, and we go in, and they're like, "It's the same premise, but also with a plumber." I was like, "Oh, well, what are the chances?" Like, we could have picked any other job, but we both.
Well, we could tell. We went through the kind of thought process of, and you're like, "Well, the plumber fits the best because it's like you're getting your hands dirty. It's a job that doesn't really benefit from exposure at all. Yeah. Like even carpenter, oh, he's a great carpenter. Look at this, what he made. Like, you know, plumber.
Yes,
look
plumber
at this.
Is inherently private, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah it yeah. is. So it fits perfectly. So I can understand where they came from. But like, they did, our fans, didn't, the Italian fans didn't believe us. And why would they?
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
Yeah, that's Emilia Ladeira for the plumbing. You know, like yeah. it's the same sketch, but it's Italian. Oh, yeah. You couldn't believe it.
And the dude was even dressed like me as well. He had the he was dressed like an absolute sap, like basically. Yeah. Oh,
was it an advert? That it made into an advert? Was that,
no, I don't
no,
think so.
No, it's just a sketch. Yeah.
Just a sketch.
Are there other things? Are there other benefits to being TV famous that you don't get from being online? Because I see every so often I'll see someone who is known as a YouTuber who is doing a TV show, who's guesting on a TV show, some sort of comedy format, game show, panel show, whatever. And I think obviously the TV show benefits because they're, or they hope to benefit. They hope they're getting the YouTuber on there and some of the YouTuber's fans. There's got to be something in it for the YouTuber as well. And I kind of I don't remember exactly where I'm remembering this conversation from, but I'm sure I spoke to someone who said, oh, well, the thing about YouTubers is they all want to be TV famous because even though they've got a million subscribers, they're all around the world, they don't get recognised walking down the street. Hmm. So there must be some other kind of benefits. Like maybe once you start to be TV famous, you become, you know, once you get to kind of household name, then there's other kinds of options and then you turn up in the MCU or, do you know what I mean? All that kind of, that sort of stuff. Yeah. Like, does any of that appeal? Does any of that register? Or is it purely to do with, it's the three of you working together as a team?
Oh, no, I guess they still get recognised walking down the street, the YouTubers.
Yeah, there is a public mentality, though. If you're on the telly, you're famous. If you're on YouTube, you're not.
Yeah.
That's just a mentality of people.
Which is a nice way to be.
It's 100%. Nice.
100%. We're now, to what extent do you want to be famous? Being famous is awful.
But, like, comedy is supposed to be, like, if you can, I always say, like, comedy works best in the corner of, a bar. You know, like, well, obviously, people with good lighting and people can see and all the other things. Like, a good comedy venue that's kind of grimy, that's where it works better. And the internet, on YouTube or Facebook, that is that in media terms. Do you know what I mean? It's
the rough and ready.
Yeah, it is. You know, television is the polished, the polished article. Television is the fancy room, the fancy function room where the comedy's taking place. And I just think comedy works better in the
definitely
grimy.
Yeah, and even like perception of people. People have forever. TV has been the thing you have to get on to be famous. It's flipped now, but it hasn't changed, I think, in people's mentality. So it's just, it's kind of interesting. Like they see you doing, people come up to us all the time and they're like, fair play to you for making those videos. I hope you keep it up. And then you can, maybe someday you could make it your full-time job.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
you're like, well, we've been, okay, thank you.
Yeah.
But then someone, if you've been on TV for, 10 minutes, people think you're rich and you're famous.
Sure.
So it's just a funny mentality.
When you're popular on people's phones, for example, they watch you and they watch you maybe regularly, but they don't know that everyone else watches you, say on like the person beside them on the train, whereas it's assumed if you're on TV, oh yeah, the person on that train does watch this, the 9 out of 10 cats or whatever I watched last night. The person on, so they see you and go, oh my god, you are a cult classic, one knows you, and they go, oh, and then they're probably more excited to see you because they think that you're a diamond in the rough. How did I bump into this person?
There's a closer connection there as well.
Closer connection.
But as well, I mean, like, if you're on TV, you're invading people's homes against their will. You know, like, they have pressed the button and then your face has come on. Like,
that's where they get the hate.
That's what they get. That's what we get annoying. We don't really, honestly, we don't really get many haters or negative comments or really
barely anything,
you know.
Yeah.
And I think, well, part of it is probably, whatever, gender orientated, I would imagine. This women seem to get a lot more abuse, to be fair. But I think some of it is to do with being on YouTube and being, no one's forcing you to watch this video. You have to click onto it. And then, so there's a certain ownership over that. Whereas I think TV comedians, I think if you're on certain channels or they change a channel and they see you twice, that seems to really annoy people.
Yeah. So the Father Ted joke, if Jack turns on the tape, that gobshite again.
It's just
in your face. Like,
Or so they think, because the algorithm is showing them whatever actually it already knows.
Well, if they liked it, then it'll show it to them again. If they didn't, then it won't.
Yes, I remember reading a review of yours from years ago where it said, there's a huge queue outside McEwen Hall in Edinburgh, And the vibe of the queue is everyone in the queue is going, is this really foil arms and hogs queue? Like, because yeah. like everyone thinks they've personally discovered you themselves.
Yeah. I think that's definitely had we been on the telly, I don't think anybody would think that.
Yeah. So you get to be like, you're successful, but you're kind of permanent underdogs, maybe?
Yeah.
Maybe a good way of putting it. It's a great place to start for comedy, yeah. isn't it? Lower expectations.
Yeah. Underground, smash it. These guys shouldn't be in that big room, but we'll go along with it.
Oh, fair play to those guys.
So even when you're in a huge, just coming back to something you said at the beginning, and then we'll do a couple of audience questions if you've got time. That when you go to Edinburgh with a show that isn't ready, but you're playing to 1,000 people in McEwan Hall or 900 people or whatever it is. Yeah. Does that change? Does it change it to have a show that isn't ready when the stakes are higher? Do the stakes feel higher?
Oh, it's awful. Yeah. I hate it. The pressure.
I will try and get some of this to put online because of your faces then were an absolute picture. Adam says he's just listening.
No, that was definitely a concern. I think the show became a little bit more ready when we moved to that room. 10%.
Do you not remember the what was that?
No, don't.
Yeah,
on,
yeah. Tell us it.
What's the name of the sketch, man?
It was called...
All I can think of is the filmed version of it now.
No, it was called the Galacadonians, was it, or something?
It was just
the Poundlands.
The origins of Black Friday.
Do you know what? It had an amazing opening line. We were all dressed in this really... I'll ruin the joke if I say where we got it from, but we got from kind of cleaning products and Tupperware and holding like a toilet brush. And the opening line was, "I come from a faraway land known as Poundland." And
then the next guy would come out with equally crazy stuff with Marses and Twix. So it's starting to be like, "I come from a faraway world known as €2 world."
Yeah,
and then I had to come out with weightlifters weights on a staff which was so heavy tied around my neck, and I was from Planet Fitness, and I couldn't keep it together. I was like, this is so, because we never really do heavy based prop stuff, we just
it bombed so badly.
So that was in the preview shows.
I
loved it.
And was that in front of a large bombing. Number of people,
sorry?
Was that in front of a large number of people?
Yeah, they were sold out rooms.
Oh yeah, they were Edinburgh previews. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, I think when people come to our preview shows, hopefully because we've done, I don't know, is it 12 Edinburgh or something like that? They know that the preview shows are going to be that messing and energy you can get away with in the preview shows is actually really fun. It makes for a really fun show,
and it does take the pressure off.
And it's fresh and exciting. But yes, when you get to the full price shows,
do you know the worst one? Oh. The worst one by far is.
Oh, stop!
Right.
Stop!
So you start with the two preview shows, right? And it's brilliant crack, and you're on cloud nine, and you think you can do no wrong, okay? Yeah. Yeah. And depending on the layout of the calendar, obviously, broadly speaking, you hit you might hit a. I don't know, do you hit a Saturday there? No, you don't.
Then
really.
You get 2-for-1s.
You get 2-for-1s. You get 2 2-for-1 days. So they're kind of like, so... Again,
yeah, we start, we say, yeah. This is a 2-for-1, so it's going to be half as funny as, you know, a full price show.
And then you hit like a Wednesday sometimes at that point. And
Black
it's kind
Wednesday.
Of like, yeah, yeah, what they call Black Wednesday. But here, again, expectations low. There's not that many people in. You kind of create that siege mentality. And it's when you hit that first Saturday where... They're paying Saturday prices for a show that is only either, it's not ready, but it's kind of, you've worked a lot at it, but it's lost that initial madness, and now you're relying on the script, which isn't quite there in the first week. It never is. Mm. And then they're tough days then.
And do you remember just the follow on from so those first shows, you know, you're aiming for like 55 minutes an hour, right? And the madness and the fun of those shows where you're figuring out where the sketch is working, finding laughs, exploring, improving, and then going home the next day and trying to write it down and tighten the script up. So you have that madness that gets you through that first week, and then you get to the proper shows and you're like, right, let's do the script tonight and just make sure the script is funny, and it's lost kind of that endless and the madness. And our show one night, oh my God, it's still actually the worst. Oh,
horrors.
Oh no.
This was in the McEwan Hall, the big room. We thought it was going to be 55 minutes, and the show finished after like 41 minutes, and we're like, but that's it.
Goodbye, everyone.
Do you remember?
And we always make a point. We've always said, and this is the entirety of Edinburgh, all 12 years, we go outside and meet the crowd as they leave. Because there's nothing, you know, you want to, it's that feedback you can see on their faces if they enjoyed it, if they didn't. And we went out like blood running cold. Now, people were actually very happy, thankfully. There was one person who did say, like, that was a bit short. But she didn't mean it mattered. But, like, inside, we knew that we had shortchanged people. And we just... Yeah. Felt like death out there.
Oh, God, it was awful.
Like, it's such a big room to be only in there for 40 minutes.
It would have been queuing for longer than that, probably.
Yeah.
Oh, it was horrible. Yikes. And then, but yeah, it's when you, it was when I think we cut a sketch. We cut that sketch.
Yeah.
And then
suddenly you've the best sketch we ever did.
Then have a hole in the show, and you then, because naturally the sketches get longer as you add more jokes in, you improvise more, and then you keep the improvised bits, and but you're still improvising as well, but you keep the good bits.
Our 55 minute Edinburgh show, by the time we go on tour, because we do two halves on tour, that 55 minute show has become an hour and 20 minutes worth of material, because we just keep adding to it.
Yeah, keep adding to it. The stuff then that happens between the sketches that becomes part of it or whatever, you know. But yeah, no, that first one when you've tightened it too much. Ooh. Oh God.
Ooh, yeah.
That keep you up at night.
Do you see other sketch shows? Do you go and see other sketch shows at Edinburgh? I try to.
Yeah, every Edinburgh, I go see a lot of sketches. The guys don't really like sketch comedy.
I don't really like sketch comedy. I've always said it.
That's not true of me now.
You're okay with it. It's not my bag. It's not Bingo's thing. It's not my thing. It's like Tiger Woods is like, I don't really like golf. What?
No, do you know what the problem is? I did like sketch back in the day before we really got into doing this. The problem is I cannot sit and watch somebody else's sketch show without thinking what I would do with their sketches or how they put together the show. I cannot turn off.
Miserable man.
I know.
Enjoy it.
I can't enjoy it. I'm just like, oh, yeah. Oh, that was it. I'm just either going like, oh, that was very clever. I wouldn't have thought of that. Or like, oh, you missed a beat there. You should have done it. It would a little bit tighter. And I'm just like, stop.
To be honest, that's probably what someone with 2 degrees would probably think of. You can't switch off the brain.
Yeah, we're just not at that level.
that cognitive ability isn't there for us.
part of the reason why I ask is, are there qualities that you see in certain other sketch acts or TV sketches, anything like or internet sketches? Performers, are there qualities that you aspire to? Because you must have, like, you've got your toolkit, like you're really the punchline, you have incredibly dense punchlines, like I mentioned before, great imaginations, you've got some really nicely, I think of this song about the monks, it's such a great song, and it's like it's a song where every line is a joke, and that's so rare. Brilliant. Or the paper bag hats, where you've got that little melodrama. You know, there are certain things you do very well. And I'm interested in, like, what do you think are your secret weapons as a sketch act? What specific things do you do well? And what specific things do you wish you could do better or see other people doing and think, that'd be great if we had a bit of that?
Well, we've tried that. We've tried to get better at certain things. Like, we went to a class with Phil Burgers, the clowning expert.
Oh, yeah.
Who's absolutely brilliant, and we adore him. And
we went because his watching his shows when we were playing, like, Just the Tonic of the Case, we just went back to see his show about 7-8 times, crying with laughter.
Yeah, and we're like, what is this? What is he doing here?
He doesn't care when it goes wrong.
Yeah, and then of course it turned out that he teaches this, and then this clowning thing, which is, you know, finding the funny in being bad, being humiliating yourself. And then we did this really tough Monday to Friday 9 to 5 course with him, and really pummeled us. He really pummeled us, and he wouldn't let us use any of our, like, you know, comedic techniques that we would
rely
really on.
He's good at that, right? Yeah. He's like, yeah, sure, that's funny, we've seen that, give something else.
And then you're good at that. And he wants to see, and he really showed us something that we didn't know we could use, which is our own humanity, shall we say, if we get pretentious about it, you know, being vulnerable on stage and the audience just liking you as a person and using that, and then you humiliating yourself for our entertainment and then harnessing that to further on the show.
Yeah, to create something, to get something out of it.
Yeah.
The removing of your masks, you know, they talk about, like, as a performer or as a person, really, where you're going to wear these masks and your ego, your protection, whatever.
Yeah.
And it's just...
so clever. Here's a
comedians must be the people with the most amount of masks, because you've kind of... You've made yourself funny in order to cope with the... The tragedy of life,
you've a burning desire to be funny and to be that entertainer,
and then you're going on stage in front of, like, audiences and doing 5 minutes, and, like, the audience is rough and doesn't like your shouts out things at you, and, like, build up all these layers,
shields, full suit of armor by the time you get up there.
But I guess that's one thing we definitely learned from Phil Burgers and from his his show. But I think in answer to your question, your other question, which was, you know, what do we do?
Yeah, what do you consider are your superpowers as a sketch group?
I think we would like to.
People keep mentioning our dynamic. That's the only one that I guess said back to us.
Yeah, well, people love it in a show when stuff goes wrong, and I think that's where the dynamic comes in, because we intentionally involve the audience in our shows because there's a chance for it to go in a new direction or stuff to for more madness to happen. And when it goes off the rails like that, people seem to love the show more when it goes wrong, probably because of how we play off each other, which is a lot to do with, obviously, Phil Burgers and what we learned with him.
Sitting in that show, I mean, I know you mentioned at the start, like, oh, look, it's all gone a mess. But, I mean, it's more kind of like, it's more dealing with that, but then crafting something out of it rather than abandoning, you know, like, it's not, it's it goes to pieces, but then the pieces are built back up into something. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. You always use what happens.
Yeah, use the mistake. Use the bad thing that happens.
Yeah, to craft a new narrative from that, you know?
It's the not panicking when it goes wrong that we've gotten good at over the last 6 years, maybe. In early days, remember when stuff went wrong early days, then we would just go faster. We would just do the material faster.
We've got to break that 41-minute record.
Yeah, because we're like, we know we've a banging joke coming up in 28 lines. Let's just get there now.
You don't like our material. Well, how about you like it faster?
Yeah. It was terrible. But now we're so much more
and
relaxed.
Louder. We'd probably be louder.
We were louder.
Faster. Jesus. Yeah.
It's like a
one of those videos of like it's B movie, but every time they say the word B, it speeds up by 1.2 or something. Have you seen?
Oh,
that?
Really?
Yeah, it's like a gradually accelerating, terrifying. Yeah,
exactly.
Oh, yeah. But now I think we can trust you. We know now that if it goes wrong, hold on, just sit in it. Let's try and work it back. We're with these people for 2 hours. Let's work it into the show. Let's make something of it. Let's not panic, basically.
Yeah, definitely. But I think when I see other sketch groups, I always want them to talk to us as an audience. You know, to look you in the eye like a stand-up does. You know, so a stand-up will tell a very personal story, but it'll make, or she, will make you feel like you are the only people being told that story, you, everyone in this room, you know. And you want that same for a sketch. So the sketch groups that we watch, some of them are very skilled and have amazing, you know, whatever lines and everything. And I just want them to get that connection with the audience across rather than play a scene as if we're watching telly. Do you know?
Do you know what part of it is probably what has always made us, because there's not much sketch in Ireland, certainly not when we were starting out, but there's always been tons of sketch in the UK. But the UK sketch groups, generally speaking, always have blackouts. So they do their scene, you see them in character, they have a blackout, and then when the lights come back up, they are a new character in a new scene. But you never see them. They never drop character to talk to you in between the sketches. And I think that's something that's different. It just happened to us by accident because we were doing comedy clubs where they were like, you want a blackout? You're joking. There's no tech in this room.
Yeah,
so we developed the symbol. But we have now those moments in between shows where we are more like stand-ups just talking to you. And then we go back into character. But yeah, maybe a lot of those sketch groups with the blackouts, they miss that. The personality coming across.
The personality, yeah.
We also do our own warm-up act as well, where we go out into the audience at the start a lot these days, and we're messing around with them, and
really fun. I mean,
very much personal and in your face.
Yeah,
and like
they can evolve into sketches as well. And a few things. I'm really sorry to have missed this part, or I really miss doing this. But I used to do like a guided tour of every venue. The start of the show, which was you'd kind of start to like bullshit facts about the theatre and when it was built in the 16th century by Florence Nightingale or whatever, like nonsense that come into your head, and then you'd get people from the audience up
to follow the tour,
you know, and then you'd kind of berate them, look around, look interested, you know, and then you get more people and you'd have like six or seven people, and the theatres are all different, you know, so there's different doors that lead to different places, so you could take them outside. Sometimes the theatres would have doors that would lead to the street, and then suddenly you're in the street with them, but your radio mic is still working, and you know, there's a lot of fun to be had.
There's a lot that can go wrong, and then we can hopefully use.
You can use all of that. All of that can be used then for the rest of the show, whatever you get from all that seeming. And it doesn't matter if it doesn't work, if a joke there doesn't work, because if you reference it again later on and you make it work within a new context, you just get extra marks or points or whatever you want to say it.
Rebecca Thorpe asks, have you ever had a big comedic or creative disagreement? What was it about and how did they resolve it? We've heard a lot about the process, voting. It all seems plain sailing. Has there been one time that sticks in your memory as like a falling out?
No. Nothing.
Any grudges or feuds?
No.
There was the end of like a UK tour where we were just so exhausted. I think we just didn't want to look at each other.
Yeah, that was a long time ago.
That was a long time ago. This is like when we were driving like 8 hours to do a show to four people and then like, oh God, and then another 6 hours or somewhere else. It was a horrible tour and then we were just like...
Was that the budget tour I organized where I was in charge of the logistics?
And it was pretty good.
And I booked the cheapest possible accommodation and transport you could find.
That's
and
great.
I found it. Like, God, we made a profit that year.
Yeah, we did.
Because, God, it was miserable.
Yeah, it was miserable. No, I don't know.
There's
don't
never
think
been
so,
anything like where we've had a fight about it.
We wouldn't be going artistic. This long, to be honest with you, as a sketch group, if that happened at any semi-regularly even. I mean, we often hear about other sketch groups and they're long since Lord rest their names, but they're gone. You know, they didn't last. And it's because they just couldn't figure out a way to come to an agreement on things. It helps that there's three people, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. You know,
not too many.
Not too many.
Yeah.
But you have to be willing to let go. I guess you kind of see the writing on the wall, really. If you're unwilling to let go of your idea, then the other person might do the same. You know, the next day, and then what have you? Just like,
we've just gotten better at taking the criticisms because they're not criticisms about you, about your jokes.
Yeah,
people take them as criticisms initially. Then you learn that it's not.
Well,
you
trust the other person so much now that you know that they're doing it for the right reasons. Yeah. They're not doing it to get back at you because you didn't like my joke earlier, so now I'm going to pretend not to like your one, even though it's really good. Yeah. Like that, that doesn't go on because you'd be screwed then.
I think the big thing as well is that we pooled our personal ambitions into one collective ambition. So I think a lot of sketch groups fall apart because, we are all actors, I guess, you know, but like it's a lot of actors come together and then one actor wants to go off and do that and that's the end of the sketch group. But
one gets a small part in Peaky Blinders and the other gets, you know, an advert and suddenly they're whatever, but financially, we pool everything together. So even though we have individual kind of like voiceover work or advert work, it all goes into the
same pool.
It all goes into the same pool. It all gets shared.
All the same bank accounts, yeah.
No way. Sorry, that took me a second to get my head round.
One
of you will go off and do an advert and get a couple of grand for it and put it into the company account.
It all goes into the company.
We've done that since
you're my heroes. That's the best thing I've ever heard.
That's been doing that since about 2010 or something.
Yeah, that's a great system.
While you're doing your advert, earning the money, they're off writing, you know?
Yeah.
So you're all working.
Yeah.
I think that's the best thing I've ever heard in comedy.
Incredible. That's probably maybe something that we didn't see, but that probably is a glue.
That is pretty glue. Because also, like, when at the moment, I mean, let's face it, anytime one of us gets offered something, it's off the back a large degree of, you know, hey, it's the Four Arms and Hog guy.
So
you kind of can't just disregard that and take your money.
So does that mean if you need to send in a self-tape for something, the others are like G-ing you up, we want this gig, you've got to go out there and bring home the money?
Well, we do. There's been times where we've sent in like tapes, auditions, the three of us have sent it in and we're like, well, one of us will probably get it. And that means we all of us.
That's the best thing I've ever heard.
That was so funny because there was a voiceover recently and we're like, I was on the phone and the voiceover agent was saying to me, listen, it's down to two people. And I was like, oh, okay, you're one of them and Sean Flanagan is the other. And I was like, you mean like Flango? Yeah, from the group. I was like, well, I don't really care. I actually hope he gets it because I get the same money and I want him to do it. But as it transpired, none of us got it. They went a different direction. Oh, give us a break.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Finally, then, what's the plan? Like, you get 1 million subscribers next, then what? 10 million? What's the plan?
That sounds like a good plan
like a good plan.
What you just said. I don't know if we have a...
Yeah.
No, I don't know if... I mean...
We're not in the comedy business.
We're in the
empire business.
Yeah, it would be nice to get 1 million subscribers on YouTube, I would imagine. I don't know what that would do. It probably wouldn't change an awful lot.
Nice for the ego.
Yeah, that's probably it, yeah. But I think I'd like to probably, at some point, you know, working on a sitcom, I'd like to put that together. But then again, it's only just really an option. It's not...
Yeah. It's not the goal.
It's not a necessity.
Same as a movie is in my head. It would be really nice, I think. Somebody mentioned to us before, an agent says, like, it'd be nice to have something that you can look back on and go, like, that was professionally made. All the stuff we make is...
Something that had a bit of money behind it that looked good that you could then...
Really stand over the test of time, I guess.
Yeah, that was that.
But that's not an urgency either. No, because we're very happy doing what we're doing at the moment.
It's probably, like, I often say it to the lads, like, even no matter where things go, like, this is it. Like, you know, you come into your office, you write something, you film it yourself, you put it out. No one says what you can and can't do. You choose. Yeah, and
we're living the dream.
You've all of the crack and none of the weight of production staff and time, and you know, you control it all yourself. Like,
we're living the naff YouTuber dream.
The naff YouTuber dream.
Are you happy?
Oh, very, absolutely, very, very lucky.
Ask us that again in about six months when we go back on tour proper and are doing the videos at the same time. That's when it gets tough.
And then 10 years after that, when Sean Flanagan's an Avenger and he's still splitting his money three ways.
Oh, that's got to be rolling his eyes.
I'll be in Sicily on the beach.
Cashing my checks.
And I'm like, they brought me back for another one. Another one. That's 8 of the Avenger movies I've done.
I think you're really great at them. Yeah.
That short, curly character. I don't think he's any good, is he?
He's brilliant.
Oh, he's great.
Okay, fair enough.
So that was them. What a lovely bunch of boys. What a great thing that was. 40 minutes of extras at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. Or if you're already in the gang, it'll be on your private feed now. And of course, if you haven't yet joined, then you can also get the exclusive insiders Q&As recorded via Zoom with Nish Kumar, James Acaster, Fern Brady, Alfie Brown, and the amazing Self-Help for Comedians special with Amanda Donnett. Tremendous amount of stuff to enjoy. Follow Foil Arms and Hog predominantly on YouTube. I guess I'm still waiting for them to send me their list of CTAs, that's calls to action. But I guess their main thing is subscribe, subscribe, subscribe. So find them on YouTube. The content there is great. Some of the sketches we mentioned, paper bag hats is just a brilliant place to start. The one-man play is a great place to start, but I think you'll enjoy that more once you know them a little better. Like, it's so good, you should save it up and savour it. And of course, all of their big, chunky format ones. Different rooms of your house, go to a party and how they behave. All that stuff. They're so imaginative, and they just crank the stuff out so fast and so efficiently. Foil Arms and Hog, a joy to have them on. Thank you to you for listening. Thank you to Nathan Wood for producing the show, Jake Crossland for doing the logging. The music was by Rob Smouten of Black Peaches, and Peter Dobbing remains your podcast consultant in defiance of God. I will post it. I won't post Amble at you. I'll just tack this on now. I've got to go out. I'm going to go do some writing with a friend who is just dipping a toe into stand-up for the first time. And we're going to write some jokes together. And I need to zip off to do that on a poncy little electro scooter. I will tell you this. Okay, that's the end of the show. This is the post Amble. Ready? I left my therapist. I completed my relationship with my therapist, the one who has seen me. Look, I've only met her in person once. The rest of it has been on Zoom during the pandemic. And she's so, so, so good. Thank you to my friend who introduced her to me. You are absolutely right. She has radically changed the way I think about. She's just let me get into a few of the long-term things and what they were all about. If you want to know more, some of it comes up on the special Panamble that I did recently about belonging. But it was a beautiful and joyful and emotional time to say, I think we're done here. Let's revise everything. The last couple of sessions have all been tracking towards, I think we might be done, but I don't want to backslide. How can I make sure I never go back? Don't put me back in the dark place. And it just completed. And as someone who has been in and out of various therapy situations, and there may be more in future, and I don't claim that that's never going to happen. And to be honest, the pod's nearly 10 years old. I think you've heard this song from me before, but this felt calm and mature and adult. And thank you, we're done. So if you're in therapy, there is a potential end in sight if you want there to be one. If you haven't done it, if I have one mission in life, try and go to therapy. I know it's not cheap. I know you've got to wait a long time on the NHS and you won't necessarily find the right person. You have to pay yourself first. Emotionally, this is an investment phrase, pay yourself first, with, you know, save your money that you need to save for your pension or whatever before you pay your bills. that's hard and difficult and you have to earn more in order to pay the bills, but it won't work if you do it the other way around. If you pay all the bills and don't save anything, then you will end up in dire straits. I think the reason I'm mentioning this is because the premise of pay yourself first, I think it applies to your happiness, and I would rather eat less good food and pay for therapy and get it done and get happy, because that's just the bedrock. I realise that's a position of privilege, and I happily check my privilege there. I know not everyone can afford it, but if you can, the key thing I'm saying is try and get some barter for it. Try and get over the bit of you that's thinking, I don't need it, I don't need it, it's not for me, I'm fine. You probably are fine, but you probably could be more fine. So please try and do that. That's my mission in life. Everyone should get therapy. All right? Toodaloo.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.